America, 877-500-KBO0.
Thanks a whole lot, Justine. It's always good to talk with you. Also, I look forward to the next time we talk, too. So
okay,
look forward
you so
to the
much,
next
Barbara.
Time we talk. We've been talking besides
so much,
we were talking today with Joel K. Warren, who's author of The End of Plenty, The Ways to Feed a Crowded World. You've been listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio.
You've been listening to Locus just tuning in. You'd like to hear Radio Mystery. You want your friends and family to hear the show. You can listen to it online and download the audio later this afternoon on our website, theaudio.fm/LocusFocus. Next week, my guest is Gary Wilson, author of Extreme Gaft, Gary Loveland, I and Jared K. Welcome to the Rusty Minigold, your music with Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening, and remember to pledge.
And it is just a few seconds before 11 a.m. on KBOO Portland. Coming up at 11 is Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman. And you'll want to stay tuned at 11:30 on the radio scene. Oregon writer Michael Helkist talks about his new biography, Marie A. Key, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions. So keep it right here and keep making those calls to 877-500-5266 because every one of your dollars counts.
Tune in to Prison Pipeline on Monday, September 14th at 6:30 p.m. to hear hosts Emma and Amy interview Lynn Stewart. Lynn Stewart is an activist, defense lawyer, breast cancer survivor, and a former political prisoner who has courageously stood up for the rights of revolutionaries, people of color, the poor, marginalized, and dispossessed for over 40 years. Join us as we chat with Lynn about her health, her time in prison, and the issues she is concerned with. That's Monday, September 14th at 6:30 p.m. on Prison Pipeline on KVU Community Radio at 90.7 FM.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, science writer Anil Ananthaswamy, is a former editor at New Scientist, and he has written also for National Geographic, Discover, and PBS Nova's The Nature of Reality, among many others. He's the winner of the British Association of Science Writers Award for Best Investigative Journalism, and his first book, The Edge of Physics, was voted Best Book of the Year in 2010 by Physics World. Ananthaswamy is here today to talk about his latest book, The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self, a book that Publishers Weekly in its starred review describes as follows. The Man Who Wasn't There skillfully inspects the bewildering connections among brain, body, mind, and society. Readers will be fascinated by Ananthaswamy's chronicles as he explores with kindness and keen intelligence the uncomfortable aberrations that reveal what it is to be human. Welcome to Health Watch, Anil Ananthaswamy.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
So as a writer whose last book was about physics, how did you come to write a book that, while grounded in science, is really also raising metaphysical questions about the nature of self?
I think the physics book was really about being curious about the cosmos, the external world. And when I wrote the physics book, it was actually bookended by visits to monasteries. The first chapter and the epilogue in the physics book are actually, there are descriptions of me going and spending some time at monasteries, because I kind of metaphorically felt like what the physicists were doing with their telescopes up on mountaintops and what the monks were doing were kind of similar. It's finally just a quest to understand, where we come from, where we're going. And to me, this was just a natural extension of that curiosity. Instead of looking outward this time, I thought I'll, take a look inward.
So you start The Man Who Wasn't There with an allegory from an ancient Buddhist text about a man who's devoured by ogres. Can you tell us a little bit about this fable and why you opened the book with it?
Yeah, I opened the book with it mainly to illustrate the fact that, thinking about who we are, trying to answer the question, who am I, is not just a recent scientific endeavor. This is something people, humans, have been doing since we probably became self-aware. And Buddhism is one of the, religions that really takes it to heart in terms of trying to understand who we are. The allegory itself is basically a very macabre one. A man encounters two ogres, and they bring a corpse with them. And one of the ogres decides that he tears the arm of the man, and the other ogre, in retaliation, tears an arm off the corpse that they have and attaches it to the man. And this proceeds, for every body part that the man has, it gets replaced by a body part from the corpse, and then the ogres eat the corpse and disappear. And the man is left wondering, well, who am I? Am I the body that I was born in, or am I the body that I have now, which is actually all body parts taken from the corpse? I mean, it's just a way of illustrating the Buddhist question of, is the self real? Is the self your body? So essentially the man starts asking those questions. And in some sense, the allegory sets up the rest of the book for me very nicely.
So would it be fair to say that the premise of The Man Who Wasn't There is to examine the self in a negative sense, in the sense by looking at people who have abnormal senses of self from a medical perspective, and then inferring back from what we learn to what a normal sense of, or a more common sense of self might be?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to use the word negative only because I think the people who are suffering from these aberrations, they are experiencing something else, but it's not like it's lessened in some way. Instead of using the word negative, I would probably just think of it as, alterations to the self that we normally perceive ourselves to be. The point is exactly as you said it, is that by looking at how our experience of being what we are changes in certain conditions like Alzheimer's or autism or schizophrenia, the hope is that we can understand how the brain constructs the self in the first place. It's almost impossible to get a sense for what our self might be unless we start looking at situations where, something goes slightly awry, and you get a sense that, okay, this is not one monolithic a thing called the self, but actually a collection of neural processes that have to constantly be working to give us the sense of who we are.
Well, maybe a good place to begin as a segue from the Buddhist allegory of the man with the body parts from a corpse is the body integrity identity disorder. Tell us what that is and what you discover in spending time with people who have this condition.
So it's a very intriguing condition in the sense that it's not something most of us would ever experience. It's a very rare condition, and it's a condition in which people feel that some part of their body doesn't belong to them. Now, if you were to look at, if you were to just pay attention to your leg or your arm, you would have no doubt in your mind that it's your own. In fact, it's not even something we think about. It's an implicit feeling that we have that we own our body, or rather that our body feels like ours. And in BIID, body integrity identity disorder, you can have the feeling that some part of your body, usually it's the extremities of limbs, is not yours. And the best way kind of to understand what this might be is to think of a mirror condition, which is phantom limbs, which is something most people would be aware of. This is what happens when somebody has had an unfortunate accident and has had to get an amputation, so a leg or an arm has been amputated, and some people after an amputation continue to feel the presence of a limb, and it's very clear that they're not really feeling the physical limb because the physical limb is gone, and yet they perceive their limb to exist. And in some sense, BIID is, you can think of it as the opposite, where your limb is fine, you know, physiologically healthy, but something about the way the limb is represented in the brain has changed or altered, leading to the perception that that limb is not yours. I did spend time talking to people who suffer from this condition, and it can be quite debilitating, especially if they've been suffering from it for a few decades, as usually is the case, before they find out that they're not alone. In the world, there are other people who are also experiencing the same thing. I remember one person I talked to, he said something like, about the leg that didn't feel like his. He said, my soul doesn't extend into that leg. And there are very many people who will use that kind of terminology to describe that that condition.
And in that rare condition where you believe an extremity isn't belong to you, your arm or your leg does not belong to you, they often want to get amputation and actually feel better having gotten an amputation. Is that right?
I think that is the paradoxical thing, that if they suffer from it for a long while, eventually they feel like the only way to reconcile this mismatch between what they perceive their body to be and what the body actually is to get an amputation or some sort of surgical procedure to alter the body. And they do say things like, I feel complete now, I feel whole now, even though, from a very objective standpoint, when you're, thinking about what has happened to the body, you've lost a limb. But in terms of your perception of oneself, you're feeling more complete and more whole. And that is very paradoxical, but that's exactly how they describe their situation.
We're talking today with science writer Anil Ananthaswamy about his book, The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self. You mentioned in the book, Anil, an experiment with a rubber hand to elucidate some very strange science around self-perception and self-identity. Could you talk a little bit about that experiment?
It's sort of in a similar vein as BIID that we were just talking about, the idea that the perception of your body is something that is quite malleable. We take our perception of our body to be kind of solid and never question the fact that this is something that the brain has to actually put together moment by moment. And the rubber hand illusion very clearly shows that this is so. You can do this experiment at home. You go onto Amazon and order a rubber hand. It just looks like a hand, except it's made of rubber. And you place the rubber hand on a table in front of you. Place, say, your left hand next to the rubber hand, and between the rubber hand and your real hand, place a screen so that you can see only the rubber hand and you can't see your real hand. Now, have someone take two paintbrushes and stand in front of you and stroke both your real hand and your rubber hand simultaneously at exactly the same places at the same speed, on different fingers, but basically mirroring the action on your real hand on the rubber hand. And remember, now you're only looking at the rubber hand. You cannot see your real hand. So there are two things happening now. You're getting a visual input, which is the rubber hand being stroked by the paintbrush. And you're getting a sense of touch coming from the paintbrush touching your real hand. And it's quite amazing that about two-thirds of the people in about 2 minutes after this process is started will feel something quite amazing. They will feel the touch of the paintbrush on where the rubber hand is located. They will actually feel like they are sensing touch at the location of the rubber hand. Your brain takes ownership of the rubber hand because it's being fed conflicting information. It's being fed visual input, which is, the brush on the rubber hand, and it's being fed tactile sensations coming from the real hand. And it so happens that the brain prefers, or trusts vision more than it trusts the sense of touch. And it decides that, oh, the touch must be coming from the location of the rubber hand, and ends up embodying the rubber hand. And this is a very, very strange thing to experience if you're one of the lucky ones to experience it. Not everyone will, but, 70% of people will, and that's quite a large number.
And it points at the ways in which self is constructed neurally or neurologically. And I just wanted to go to how you end the book what you talk about, a trip where you go to Varanasi, the holy city of the Hindus, and then on to Sarnath, where the Buddha gave his first sermon. And then go into this old notion in Buddhism of non-self or no self, and how a lot of the new science, some scientists are on the side of the idea of no self, and other scientists are not, even the ones, even if they both accept this new science. But we're not, when we're talking about the absence of self, we're not talking about the absence of a narrative self, of a phenomenological self. Can you distinguish between those two, and what people are saying when they say there's the possibility of the absence of self?
Yeah, so like you said, the phenomenal self is not an illusion, in the sense that, you know, we all experience being a self, and there is no doubt that experience is real. The question is there a self that will, you know, which is responsible for experiencing all that we experience? Is there something that will persist, for instance, after the brain and body are dead? Was it there before the brain and body came into existence, and will it be there afterwards? And that part, I think most scientists and philosophers will clearly now agree that, okay, that's not the case, that the self in that context doesn't really exist, and it's not really something solid that's, you know, separate from the mind and separate from the brain and body and mind. Now, the narrative self, which you mentioned, is the story that we all are, and it's very clear if you look at things, if you look at a condition like Alzheimer's, or there are other situations also where the narrative self starts disintegrating, and it becomes very clear that the narrative self, the story that we tell ourselves about who we are, the story that we tell others about who we are, that is something that depends on memory formation, long-term memory formation, and it's something that the brain needs to put together, and you can lose it. You can lose your narrative in the context of Alzheimer's, but then the question is, you can still experience being someone either with a narrative or with a scrambled narrative or without a narrative. So there is still an I that seems to exist below the level of what can be called the narrative self. Now, the question is, what is that I that is the experiencing self, or the self that is the subject of experiences? And that's where Buddhists will say that even that is just something that appears to be so, that if you were to actually go looking for the self that is the subject of experiences, even that you will find that there's nothing there. Whereas some philosophers, modern philosophers, and, you know, philosophers of yore would say that, no, I think we need to posit the presence of at least some very basic minimal self that is the subject of experiences, and then the brain constructs a larger narrative self on top of that. So that the distinction is at that level. They're really fussing about the notion of the subject of an experience.
Well, let me talk briefly, or ask a question briefly, about the interface between the self and a individual culture's perception or belief in self. When I was reading your book, I thought of an earlier show that I did with an organization in Oregon called the Early Assessment and Support Alliance, and they do early intervention for teenagers who've had a psychotic episode using science based on non-Western cultures that do early community and family-based intervention with someone who's had a psychotic episode that show good results to prevent schizophrenia from developing. What have you uncovered, if anything, around the interplay between individual and community and self and the group in relationship to medicine and self-dom?
I think there's a big interplay. I didn't specifically address that in the book, but it's very clear that the self that each one of us is very much a product of not just the biology that we inherit, but also the culture that we grew up in, and our parenting, our social structures. So if some disorder or a condition like schizophrenia can be thought of as a disturbance of the self, then by definition, the way the disorder will manifest itself will differ from culture to culture, because if it's a disorder of the self, then the way the self gets constructed in each culture being different, the way the disorder will, the severity of it, the outcomes for treatments, etc., all of that will have a bearing, or rather the culture will have a bearing on all of those things. It's very clear that this becomes very clear in something like depression, because depression, is really at some very basic level a disturbance of how we feel about ourselves, right? It's a disorder of the self. And in highly individualistic societies, it can be felt more acutely than in a more collective society. I think it makes sense for us to pay attention to how culture is influencing who we are, and then, tailor our treatments accordingly.
Have you followed any of the research, Anil, on the way writing may or may not affect the self as a writer and a science writer? I know that they've done a lot of research on writing and putting thoughts into words with regards to post-traumatic stress therapy.
I haven't followed that. No, not in any particular way. I mean, I can just speak from personal experience that I think writing is very grounding for those of us who like to do it and want to do it. And in some sense, I think it gives us a better handle on our own narrative self and kind of deepens our self-awareness. And that can be helpful. You can also get very neurotic, so I'm not sure that it's
right.
Only always positive. Writers are, they can be neurotic. I know that from personal experience, both within myself and, my colleagues. So I think it's a double-edged sword, but if done with care and balance, as with anything else, I think it can be very helpful.
Well, as a way to end the show today, what would be a takeaway for a listener or a reader of The Man Who Wasn't There, or some takeaways around personal well-being or insight from this new science that calls into question some of the ways in which we view the self as so stable? And some of the old philosophy from Buddhism around no self. Are there some things you could touch upon around some wisdom to garner from that?
Yeah, I think the science and traditions like Buddhism are converging in their notion of what the self is. For most part, they agree that much of what we take to be solid and unified and not malleable is actually otherwise. The narrative self, the sense we have of our own body, the sense we have of being agents of our actions, all of these things seems to be things that the brain has to construct, and in that sense it is not real, in the sense it is something that the brain is putting together moment by moment. And I think in terms of personal well-being and how we live our lives, just seeing that the things we tend to hold on to too strongly are actually things that can be let go, and things that can be let go in the sense that we can see through the construction somehow, whether it's just you mentioned writing, it could be meditation, could be just taking long walks and paying attention to oneself, whatever it is that one does in order to become self-aware. But becoming aware of the constructed nature of most things about the self, and becoming aware of the fact that this solidity is actually somewhat of an illusion, and hence not holding on to those things too strongly can only be beneficial, because a lot of our stress comes from having conceptual ideas about who we are and then wanting to live up to those ideas or taking those things as immutable, and just seeing those things for what they are and maybe stepping back a little bit can only be helpful to our well-being.
And we're talking today, me in Portland, Oregon, and you in Bangalore, India, and you're living part of the time in India and part of the time in New York. Is that change, going back and forth, change your own conception of self?
It does, and I actually, it's not New York, it's Berkeley, California.
Oh, sorry.
But you know, it does. There is very much a shift in perception of oneself as I move back and forth. India is a somewhat more collective society than the U.S. Though things are changing here too, and you know, I think the notion of an individual has morphed within India also over the last two decades. But there is definitely a change in how one feels about oneself as you know, as you move back and forth between two cultures that are so different. And they both have positives and negatives in terms of you know what the self is perceived to be, and depending on again how you deal with it and what you make of it, it can be both good and bad.
Well, it was a pleasure having you on Health Watch today, Anil.
Thank you. It was my pleasure, David. Thank you very much.
We are talking today to science writer Anil Ananthaswamy, whose book, The Man Who Wasn't There, Investigations into the Strange New Science of the Self, is available today if you call 1-877-500-5266 or go to kboo.fm and become a member or renew a member. And we have Justin and Pear to tell you more about how you can do that.
Well, like David said, the number to call is 877-500-5266. Give us a call and come on down and see us. But for a $60 pledge, this book is yours, A Man Who Wasn't There by Anil Ananthaswamy. It's really, it looks like I've got a copy of it right here. It's a fascinating book, lots of interesting chapters about the self. And it's kind of, it really is, it's an eye opener. And so KBOO is. Well, KBOO is a station that brings you this kind of programming. You don't find it anywhere else. And so if you want to hear more of it, you have to keep the station going like we have been since 1968. And we hope to keep on going with your community support. So give us a call.
877-500-KBOO to say thank you to Dr. David Naiman for his tireless work on Health Watch and for all of our cultural and political ambassadors who bring us information that we don't get elsewhere. And, you know, this was really wonderful. This looks like a very interesting book by Anil Ananthaswamy. I just want to practice out, try that out there. But I was thinking about this, you know, at KBOO, we are so often, particularly during membership drive, emphasizing the collective. But I couldn't help but think about how one's own sense of self changes when we take up things larger than ourselves. And so it seemed to me that there was this wonderful connection between sort of on the micro level of how we're thinking about ourselves, but also at a larger macro level, how we are a part of a bigger collective and how that affects our sense of ourselves. And I do believe that people who make contributions to KBOO get a sense of self as being part of a collective that they don't get when they're just being a passive listener. I'm not saying that to try and manipulate you. I'm saying you've been hearing us say for years that the signal sounds better when you're a stakeholder, when you've helped make it possible. And now I think that Anil Ananthaswamy has demonstrated that this is, in fact, the point. So don't take our word for it. Try it out right now and call 877-500-5266. Of course, you can do that online at kboo.fm, but there's no music like the sound of ringing phones during the membership drive. 877-500-5266.
Right. Just remember, we are a community. We are not just isolated little specks of being floating in a sea of mendacity and mediocrity. We are a community, and we have community power, and we can exercise that power, and we can be a kind of a self-reliant community. That is what KBOO is all about. That's why we are here. That's why we've been here now for, I don't know, was it 45, 48 years?
With your help,
we are... You know, this is our way of standing up to all the voices of illusion around us, hype and illusion.
Indeed, a beacon in the wilderness. Yeah, well, we got some help from Jay. Jay's sense of his self has been expanded into the collective. He renewed his membership, but he started a new sustaining monthly contribution. Thank you so much, Jay. You're really pointing the way for a lot of other people who maybe have yet to experience the value of being a member of a collective, the individual benefits that come from collective membership. Don't take our word for it. 877 877- 800-500-5266 is the number to call. You know, that's a modest $60 gift. That would amount to $5 a month. That would amount to 16 cents a day. 16 cents out of the $2,238 every day that the community spends on KBOO. Won't you call right now? 877-500-5266.
Or come on down and see us at 20 Southeast 8th. We are here talking to you, talking to the community. Come on down and see us. You can see where your money is going. I can guarantee us it's not going on the massive corporate headquarters we like to joke about. It goes for a very modest little building with a very pretty mural on the front, with a bulging record library. We have dedicated volunteers and staff. We have a small staff, and we have lots of volunteers. That is sort of the secret of our success, is the labor of volunteers who do this for the love of it.
As we get ready to hand it back, I just wanted to mention, Pear, our staff is normal sized, but they are few in number.
Few enough. Okay.
877-500-5266. It is true. It is less than 10 full-time positions. The real heart and soul of this mission is our hundreds and hundreds of volunteers, our thousands and thousands of contributors, and our many thousands of listeners. Call right now and say thank you. 877-500-5266.
I can swear you've increased in stature over the years.
Thank you, Perry.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the Vision Midway Alliance's third annual Festival of Nations, where cultures come together. The festival will be held at the Division Center at the intersection of Southeast 122nd Avenue and Southeast Division Street on Sunday, September 20th from 12 p.m. to 4 p.m. Catch TriMet bus lines 4 or 71 to get there. The Festival of Nations is a great time for the entire family with music and entertainment, from face painting and balloon art to the Taste of the Nations tent with a variety of food from all over the world. Vendors will sell their goods and community organizations will provide some information about available services in the area. More information at divisionmidwayalliance.com/festival.